Is this the teacher hotline?
Everybody, and welcome back to another episode of the Teacher Hotline. My name is Ronald Hay, where we try to answer some of the most pressing questions for teachers in and outside of the classroom. Today we have Peter, a high school teacher from the TDSB. Peter, how can we help you today?
Hey Ron, longtime listener, and I'm excited that you have season 3 up and running. Before I jump into my question, I want to give some context. I'm a veteran business teacher for about 30 years now, and I'm looking to transition into the next phase of my life. I thought about starting my own business, but the thought of teaching at the university level also sounds like an amazing new challenge. I remember I heard in a previous episode you did that before and always wondered how that was even possible. What qualifications do you need to teach at the undergraduate level? What are the job opportunities like? And more importantly, what are some of the biggest differences you notice between high school and university teaching? Thanks. Love the show.
Thank you so much, Peter. And yes, you are correct. In a previous life, I did have a wonderful opportunity to teach business at Western in the Business Foundations Department that was associated with the Ivy Business School. It was the best 2 years of my life, and I still look back at those memories very, very fondly. So happy to get into the nitty-gritty details with you and talk about those differences. So today I actually brought in someone from that department. We got Emma Giroux. Emma is a Business 1220 lecturer at Western University's main campus. She's been a lecturer for 2 years there now. And previous to this role, Emma graduated from the Ivy Business School at Western. So Emma, thank you so much for jumping on today's episode.
Hey, thank you so much for having me. This is so exciting for me. It's my first podcast. So,
hey.
There's a first for everything. I'm excited.
There we go. Well, we're going to have a fun time. I just want to know, Emma, did you always want to be a teacher, or is this something that kind of just fell on your lap?
Yeah, actually, ever since I was a little girl, I remember I would set up my teddy bears and I would teach to them. So I know in my heart that I always wanted to be a teacher. But when I got to, you know, grade 11, 12, and it came down to it, and I was starting to think about what I needed to do career-wise, my dad found Ivy Business School and was really just like gung-ho because I was a very well-rounded person. So I was excited about it. I applied, but I always had in the back of my mind the fact that, you know, I want to be a teacher. So probably very much like you, when I got into my fourth year at Ivy, I saw the job posting for Business Foundations, first year business lecturer at Western. And I was like, oh my God, not only do I get to be a teacher, but I get to be a teacher at the best university in the world. So,
yeah, let's jump into that actually, because that was one of the caller's main questions was in terms of qualifications and just how is this even possible? And honestly, when I even tell my friends this, or even people just outside my circle, they're very confused. They're like, what do you mean you taught at a university? Like you were 25, like you must have meant like you're a TA, right?
Yeah.
And it's a very common question. People think we're TAs. And I always say to them, no, we hire TAs. No, I have my full 3 sections. I get my own office. And it's just such a hard thing to even explain in a job interview. So maybe you could explain to some of the callers, you know, how did you get this job? What qualifications do you have? Did you need? Did you have to have a certain grade to get this job? Like, how does this all kind of work?
Yeah, I would say it's definitely like you said, when you tell people, I'm only 23 years old. So when I tell people that I'm doing what I'm doing, they are equally shocked still to this day. But in terms of qualifications and how it works, I think it's very niche and specific to Ivy Business School. I only have my undergraduate degree, and it's a 2-year contract. So I know for sure actually that I wouldn't be able to continue lecturing at the university without pursuing some form of a master's or a PhD. But because it's a 2-year roll-on contract, what Ivy does is they take their graduates and they get them to teach the Business Foundations courses to first and second year students, which I think is phenomenal, because who better to teach the case method than the people who literally graduated from Ivy Business School. So that's how it works. But I very much, when it comes to an end in terms of qualifications, I will no longer be qualified, if you will.
Right. Honestly, I think it's a great setup that Western has. I think every university should have something like this. Because when you think about it, this is a win-win-win situation for everybody. Totally. Win-win for people like you and I out of university. We get this very prestigious job. We get to teach business to university students at a very great school. The students win because they get young teachers who are hungry to do well, that are relatable to them, that just went through the process. The school wins because, number one, if let's be honest, they don't have to pay us as much as compared to, let's say, the 20-year professor veteran. And of course, the professors win, the ones that actually have been doing this for 20 years, because let's be honest, they probably don't want to teach 18-year-olds, right? They rather probably go teach their master's or their PhD programs and focus on their research. So
yeah.
I think it's a win-win-win for everybody. So it's a genius model that Western has come up with.
I totally agree. And I think it also, like, bringing young people who just got out of university and have the perspective of what it felt like to be a student and what it felt like to literally take these courses also makes it even stronger. And I feel like every single person in the department just comes in with all these ideas of how we can make the curriculum better. And I just think that's so important in education, to keep focusing on ways that you can keep elevating it. And so it's unlike anything I've ever seen. And I think it's absolutely beautiful.
Yeah. Just for context, maybe you can help explain to a listener, just very high level, mm-hmm. what's the difference between a professor versus a lecturer? Because I think at the university level, sometimes those words kind of just gets used very interchangeably. But you are a business lecturer. What's the difference between a prof and a lecturer?
Yeah, honestly, from my understanding, I think to be considered a professor, you would need to have a PhD. So I think that I'm a lecturer in the sense that I have my undergraduate degree and I just don't have a PhD, in the same way that you're considered a doctor once you have your PhD.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think that's also the thing that gets you to stick around, right? A lot of times you have to have that PhD, and they hire you to not just teach, but also to do the research.
Yeah.
So if you're looking to teach, I remember when I was looking into a PhD, my marketing prof at Western said to me, he's like, listen, if you want to go teach, like, maybe getting your PhD is not the thing for you. Sure, you get to teach a couple classes, but really the main bulk of your work and contract is to publish papers and research and do that for the school. I was like, oh, maybe university teaching is it for me then.
I know. And I think it's interesting too, because a lot of the time PhD candidates don't even want to be teachers, right? But then they're almost forced to as a part of the credentials. So that's why I think it's almost beautiful to have the option of lecturers as well, because there are people who actually like to public speak and want to be there. And I think that's important.
Yeah, I remember in first and second, heck, all the way up till fourth year, there's always profs that you sit in their classes and you're like, man, like this is not a good class. Like, how did I spend thousands of dollars on this class? This person is teaching me nothing. I'm sure you're so smart. You're a genius. I'm sure you got plenty of publications under your name, but the teaching is just so awful. So I think schools should focus on hiring a set of lecturers to focus on the teaching, and then hire your PhD candidates and your professors to do the research, right?
I think so too, and especially when your job is literally to public speak, right? Like, that's you're entertaining people almost for a living, and you can tell when they don't want to be there. And just like you said, I've had my fair share of lectures that were like that too. And being on the other side of it and seeing how much you can do and how much you can offer the students, if you just, I don't know, bring some energy to the table. And it is a little more frustrating thinking back on professors that were a little bored with what they're doing. Let's put it that way.
Yeah, no, I agree. So let's maybe focus on your role as a lecturer.
Sure.
Let's talk about your responsibilities. Besides teaching, what else do you do? And maybe you can even talk about how many hours do you teach in a week?
Yeah, so actually, I had a really unique opportunity this year. I was asked to overload. So last year, the amount of courses that would be considered a full-time job is 3.0 in my department. So I have 4.0 this year. So I'm actually lecturing more than a lot of my colleagues. So I teach 3 hours on Monday, 6 hours on Wednesday, and then 3 hours on Friday. And then in terms of my responsibilities, I have to have at least 5 hours of office hours per week. Now when there's evaluations, that goes up. So if you have an exam coming up or anything like that. And then we have weekly meetings where we prep the content and make sure everyone's on the same page. And then we also write cases, which I actually think is very special and very unique because I've become a published author, as you are as well.
Yeah, no, it's that is a really neat thing. I kind of knew that going into the job. Well, Ivy's known for their cases, and obviously the cases don't just pop out of nowhere. It's people like you and I and the profs that
Yeah.
actually have to write them, publish them, go through a whole editing process. And it's actually kind of really neat to kind of see your name as a author and then people being able to buy your work.
Yeah, I think it I think so too. And the really cool part about it is your case could be sold anywhere. You know what I mean? Like someone could be teaching in Hong Kong, somebody could be teaching it in all these different places that you don't even know. And like that's absolutely beautiful. And on top of that, it'll more so be taught at Western University and as an exam case. And like, how full circle is that for us?
It's really cool, actually. I have obviously some of my grade 12 students now go through you and some of the programs
Yeah.
at Western, and some of them will take pictures of the cases that I've published from like 10 years ago,
Oh my
actually. I
gosh.
believe you're still teaching one of them, Snakes and Lattes, I believe, right?
You wrote Snakes and Lattes?
I wrote Snakes and
I
Lattes.
did
My name is
not
on
realize
there.
that. Shut up. Oh my
Yeah,
gosh.
check out the author name next
Oh,
time. It's at the
stop
top of the
it.
page. It's you got Ronald Tay over here
And
publishing that
oh
case.
my God, everyone knows in the department, just for all the listeners, it's one thing to have your case used as an evaluation, but it's another thing to actually get it taught in the curriculum. So that's a big deal.
Yeah, when they told me that it was taught in the curriculum, I was like, get out of here. My case is in the curriculum.
Yeah,
So
like
that's great that you guys are still
religiously.
using it after 10 years.
Yes. Oh my God, that's so phenomenal.
So maybe talk about the summer hours, because as a high school
Yeah.
teacher, we finish in June. We get the 2 months off. What's the summer look like, and do you need to do anything in the summer?
So we because universities actually finish in April, so I'm actually done closer to like, I don't know, April 25th around by then, which is interesting because when you think about it, I have from like that time until September. You're probably like, what are you doing? So yeah,
Yeah.
a couple things that
What do you
I
do,
guess.
Emma?
So for the first 2 months, May and June, we actually have summer school, so intersession. And what's really, really unique about the department is we actually use that as an opportunity to train the new lecturers. So they fully teach it, but we, as senior lecturers, so people who have been in the job for more than 1 year, are in charge of training them to do it. And we sit in on the lectures, we give them feedback, and we prep them for the lectures, et cetera. And it's a really hands-on way of learning how to public speak. I honestly think it should be almost the recruiting process for any teaching role. I think it's fantastic. And then for the other 2 months, I wrote my cases. So really a lot of time off in July and August. I was kind of just building my own
Yeah.
schedule, not to discredit how much work my cases were. They absolutely were a lot of work, but I would be lying if I didn't say it, a lot of time on my hands.
Yeah, no, I agree. I loved it about that job. Well, going back just to summer school, I just want to say I love the training
Yeah.
process that at least, your department has set up. I would honestly go as far as saying that 1 month or 2 months of summer school that I remember I had to teach as a new recruit was probably more useful than the full years of teachers college that I went through.
That's
It
crazy.
taught me how to prep a lesson. It taught me how to get in front of a classroom. It taught me how to manage a classroom. It was honestly that it was like teachers college on steroids, this
Yeah.
1 month. And I still credit that the department and the whole training process that I went through to the teacher who I became today. So yeah, it's a great training process. And the fact that you get to now teach other teachers how to teach is also kind of a neat experience as well.
Absolutely. And you You got this job, that my job, after you finished teachers college, correct?
Yeah, I kind of went through this weird process where I graduated from Ivy.
Right.
I didn't go get the job right away. I actually went into the workforce, worked at Cadbury for about a year,
Yes.
realized I hated my life and quit that job to then go to teachers college with the full intention actually to go get a job at a high school. But then I remember like a light bulb went off. I was like, oh my God, wait a second. I'm pretty sure Western hires teachers.
Yeah.
And I thought that this teaching degree probably would have actually set me apart. And they ate it up at the interview. They're like, oh my God, we gotta hire this guy. So
Absolutely. And it worked out tenfold. The two of them went hand in hand.
yeah, 100%. So one of the main questions that the listener asked was, what are the major differences between a high school and university? And you know what? This is probably the best part of the conversation because I want to know, what do you do that's different than what I do? Because it's interesting, you teach really the same age group that I teach, right? We both teach 18-year-old kids
Pretty
at the end
much,
of the day.
yes.
But it's going from grade 12 to first year is a big, big jump.
Totally.
And I remember going from that job to grade 12. And I'm like, oh, this is going to be easy. Like, yeah, I could do this. And it was a really tough transition for me. Really, really hard. It took me a long time to become a high school teacher because I was stuck in my university lecturer ways. And I really had to adapt. So this is kind of a fun conversation to kind of talk about the differences between university teaching and high school teaching because
Yeah.
it's very, very different. So maybe let's start with the high level stuff. Number one, how many students do you teach per year and per class?
So my course is a full year course. So the amount of people in one classroom is around 80. But then in total, because like I said, I have four, if you times that by four, it's like 320. So I have 320 students per year.
Damn. Yeah, obviously at the high school level, you going through high school, you would know that, a class size could be 30, 35 on the big side.
Yeah.
I'm very fortunate at the private school level. My grade 12 class has kids in it. My biggest class is 19 with my grade
Crazy.
11s. So it's weird to
It's like
go
a
from,
one-on-one tutoring session.
yeah, it's really weird to go from 80 students to then 8 students. I was actually missing the bigger classes because I love the energy in the room that 80 kids
Yes.
provided, right?
Yeah, I can imagine because I mean, I feed off of it and I'm sure that you do too. It's like there's something about actually having a room of people laughing and hearing it that cheers
Yeah.
you on, you know what I mean? So when you only have like eight students, if the, I don't know, 80% are laughing and then 20% are not, that sounds very different in an eight student classroom.
Oh, 100%, 100%. Now, I always say I like a bigger class, but I realize how lucky we were because when you teach at a university level, I would say most people care and want to be there. Whereas, if you tell a high school student, hey, you're going to have 80 kids in your class, teachers are going to freak out. So I get it.
Yes.
It's just not feasible. Even with 35, I know how difficult that could be. Because I'm sure the biggest thing is marking. How do you grade all those assignments and exams? Can you talk about how that works? Do you guys have TAs? How does the marking work there?
Yeah. So there's about like five different evaluations throughout the entire year, and three out of the five I have teaching assistants that grade, which is phenomenal. And I was really fortunate this year because I got four really, really hardworking and diligent TAs. If you have poor TAs, you can run into trouble because then you have to go in yourself and fix what they've graded because whatever you've communicated to your students needs to be reflected in all 80 of those reports or exams. So it's a bit dicey there in terms of when you hand it back to them, you have to be so diligent in checking them over. But then two evaluations. So, for example, their final exam, I'm gonna have 320 exams to grade on my by myself in 2 weeks.
Yeah, it's tough. Even with the TAs, it's a lot of work, right? You got to number one,
It is.
trust the TAs because you're the one hiring them. You got to make sure that
Yes.
you hire the right people, be on the same page, making sure that the TAs kind of all grade consistently. I found that actually probably the most trickiest part is the consistency across the TAs,
Absolutely.
right?
Absolutely. And I try to ensure, so I have four sections, four TAs. Every time there's an evaluation, I switch them out. So every class has been graded by the same, you know what I mean? Like every
Yeah.
TA that I have, just to try to make it fair. But you're right, like it'll never be 100% consistent. And
Yeah.
that's very scary because one of the hardest things I would say about the job actually is when I do give their grades back.
Yeah. The grades given back is probably the most challenging part, whether I think for a high school teacher or a university lecturer. I had the pleasure of bringing my grade 12 students to Emma's class. That's actually how we met, for those of you listening. And the class that we sat in on was actually one of the classes where they were getting back their finance exam. And it was just so funny to be on the other side to see all the students get their grades back and look at the grades. And the business department does this thing where you publish the average and the median and all that stuff. And I think the average, I can't remember now, 68, 70 for that finance exam, or?
Yeah, it should have been 68 probably. Yep.
Something along those lines. And you could just see everyone's jaw drop because that's the first assessment that you guys give back, right?
It is. Yep. And you know what? Every time it never fails to shock them. Yeah. I think this year I was actually very fortunate. I didn't get a lot of students coming back and complaining to me. I had a couple ask just like how they could do better in the future. And I really respect that. But last year I got absolutely sewered with a bunch of students who I think were coming from high schools where they were able to, I don't know, you know,
talk to their teachers.
Negotiate
with their teachers.
Yeah, exactly. And like, they had no idea that like the level of their work wasn't even probably deserving of what I gave them. Like I could, if I had to reevaluate, I could give them lower.
Yeah.
So I don't know, the sense of entitlement, I think it's very difficult when they're, and I think that's probably one of the biggest differences between high school and teaching mine. And it's very tough because they're making that transition with me. And it's like, they get my evaluations back and they're just so offended that they could ever get any lower than a 95%. But that's just so unrealistic, right?
Oh, 100%. No, I totally agree with you. It's, I think that is definitely the biggest difference, I think, in terms, and we all know it because we all went through it, this, the grading process. And I say to my grade 12s, the toughest part about my job as a grade 12 teacher, especially at a private school where it's a university prep school where everyone goes to university and everyone's very gung-ho and motivated, is that it's giving them a grade that is reflective and honest to their work, but also giving them a chance to get into the universities that they should get into, and I think that they would thrive in getting into, because here's the challenge about high schools is there's no consistency. Like I teach the grade 12 accounting course and I give them honestly the hardest work, and I'm a pretty tough marker, and I don't want to disadvantage them to, let's say, to your point, a teacher at some school out of nowhere just giving out 99s like it's growing off trees, right?
Absolutely.
It's this very, very fine balance. And heck, I even got a student coming to me, I think next week, who's complaining about a 88 that I gave them on an assignment.
My God.
I was like, oh, you get out of here. like, don't bother me about this. Are you crazy? 88? But to your point, they're so anxious about grades. And so I'm not surprised by the time they get to you, not only are they shell-shocked, but now they feel like, oh my God, I got to talk to you about this.
Yeah. And I mean, the hardest part for me, I really don't like having those conversations. I don't want to sit someone down and be the bad guy. You know what I mean? And it's like, I actually know in that moment, this student has never been humbled before. I have to humble them.
Yeah.
I have to do it. I have to be the one to say, I'm sorry, but there are 20% of people, if they got like a 70, right, that are did a lot better than you and might have worked a lot harder than you. And it's a really big, tough reality check coming from what we just discussed of what you were saying about trying to get them the high grades so you get in. And it's just, it's a very, I don't know. I feel like I definitely left some bad taste in some students' mouth, which sucks, but.
Yeah, I don't like the politics about grading, whether it's, I remember back in teaching first year versus versus even in high school now, like just everyone thinks they deserve the highest. I even had parents call me out and complain about an 85 that I gave her their daughter. I was like, oh, my daughter's never received below a 90. My husband has a MBA and I have a blah, blah, blah. I'm like, come on, like your daughter's taking this grade 11 accounting class for the first time in her life. You're telling me she knows everything? She's supposed to get a 95 on a platter? Like, sorry, you didn't buy the premium tuition package that got you an automatic 99, right?
And when you think about it intuitively, like a 95 is saying that you only mess up 5% of the time. Yeah. When you're first learning something, that makes absolutely no sense.
Yeah, it's challenging. I think even though the grading is very, very different, I think the similarities are the same in the sense that just having these battles, they don't go away.
No, they don't. And you know what? Honestly, I'd love to actually chat with you because I did see you have a question about, and you just said it about parents. So I was interested in hearing just how often do you hear from parents? And then I wanted to contrast that with how often I would hear from
Yeah, well, it's funny. That was actually one of my prepped questions. In terms
parents.
of parents, I hear, oh man, I definitely hear a whole bunch throughout the year. Like, I got a call from a parent before the Christmas holidays, like, literally, as I'm shutting my email down, about their kid's grade where they got a 88 on it. And again, they weren't able to get a hold of me. We played some phone tag. And then the kid eventually emailed me after the break, and we sat down and we chatted. And I think the kid understood. Who knows? He didn't look too happy. But no, I would say that's probably the tame end. Like last year, the example I gave, a parent reamed me out a parent teacher interview just out of nowhere. I was like, hey, how's it going, so and so, and like, oh, I want to talk to you about my kid's grade about blah 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 blah. And it was an
Oh my gosh.
85. It was an 85. I'm like, you need to calm down. Another kid got a 70 because the kid didn't do any work. Again, dad came in hot-headed and tried to rip me a new one. And I'm like, you need to know where your place is. That's not how you talk to teachers. Just because you pay tuition doesn't mean anything. It doesn't tell you
Yeah.
anything. It absolutely infuriated me. I would say, in my 10 years teaching high school, I could probably count maybe, I'm thankful to count, I should say,
Yeah.
less than 10 interactions. I'm gonna ballpark around 5 to 7, where it just leaves that sour taste in your mouth where you can't fall asleep.
Right.
You just want to punch a hole in a wall. And you have to get like
Totally.
administration involved and all that stuff. So in 10 years, I'd say 7. Still unacceptable, I'd say, but less than what I think most people would think.
Well, that's good to hear because I was always like, that's something I feel like that I'm considering working in high schools. That's why I'm glad we're having this conversation anyway. And that's something that I feel like would hold me back because to transition to my experience as a university lecturer, I've never heard from a parent once.
Yeah, of course. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's funny, when I was in that job, I heard from one parent. A parent tried to contact me. Ironically enough, it's a private school kid.
Oh, wow.
The kid got caught for plagiarism. I know.
No.
Yeah, it was one of the
And the
first assignments.
parent?
The parent tried to call and I guess try to I don't know, explain the situation or talk me out of it. Or I don't know what the parent wanted. But I remember asking my senior, and he said, you know, we don't have to deal with these parents at the university level, right? Just you literally don't respond, you don't pick up the phone call, and you don't deal with these people. Like, no, these
Oh, I
kids
love
are in
that.
university now, and we deal with them. So I was like, this is amazing. This is great. I don't have to deal with parents.
You
But then
were
going,
like blocked.
I know, I'm like, block. But then you're right, going to high school, it is a different skill set to learn how to manage parents. In fact, one of the best PD that we got last year was our principal brought in a expert on how to deal with these parents. And really the main takeaway was, you know what, there's what we call them five percenters. There's these 5% parents that they're just not reasonable to talk to. They're living on their own planet. And these are the people you can't change, talk to, reason with. So you just have to chalk it up as a, I don't want to say a loss, but you let the principals and the admin, the higher people take care of them. Whereas everyone else is reasonable. You could kind of talk to them and explain to them, and they're good people down in their hearts, and they just need to kind of be explained of what happened. But you get these 5 percenters, and you know, good luck.
There's just no talking them down, like the
Exactly.
one.
There's no talking
Yeah,
them
I
down. Yeah,
totally get
they don't
it.
go with
Yeah.
logic, right?
No.
But you know, I think that's everything in life, right? Whether it's not just teaching. I think every profession has these 5 percenters that just go off the rails, and I think that's just a skill set to learn how to deal with these people, right?
I think that's honestly, I was gonna say, a good way to describe life is that there's always a five percenters. Like,
Yeah.
I feel like that's an analogy you could use it anywhere. I feel like there's a five percenters of my students. And what I was just talking about, when I have to tell them about their grades, and then they come back to me and they just are completely hell-bent. They deserve better.
Oh,
I
yeah.
would describe it the same way.
Yeah. Yeah. There's some students that they get it. They walk away thinking, okay, that was a good explanation. Or some of them were like, you know, I'm not happy with the grade, but, you know, I'll accept it. And then there's some that will like fight teeth and nail to the end for whatever. And
absolutely.
Yeah.
And then those people grow up and then they go to parent teacher interviews.
And they turn into them.
They harass Ronald Hay. Yeah.
Exactly. I'm like, leave me alone. Speaking of plagiarism, actually, we were sort of talking about AI offline before the call started. How many times and how often do you have to deal with plagiarism or academic integrity or AI abuse now? Love to kind of hear what that world is now like for you guys.
Yeah. So honestly, it was really, really, really interesting from my perspective specifically, because when I joined the department, AI was not a thing. So in my first year, it was never a problem. I'm in my second year now and it's been introduced. So it's like almost I'm seeing technology happen and the evolution in front of my eyes, and I don't like it. So the first thing I'll say is we have five evaluations, like I said, and three of those are exams. So in terms of just academic code of conduct, nothing really goes on with those, because how can you? It's an exam, unless someone's physically trying to cheat off someone's paper. But we do have two reports, and those two reports, one ironically was just due over Christmas. That is where I see a lot of the AI. And what's really disappointing about that is it's not helpful for them, specifically in my course, because we do use the case method. I see when it could be helpful. I've heard and saw ways that students have used it for other courses, even in like with integrity, where it actually is helpful. But it is just absolutely useless, I think, for my course. And it's a waste of time. And it's just a way to get yourself in trouble and to discredit your education, just to completely waste your money.
Yeah, no, I agree. I don't know why kids do it. It's like, you're right. You're literally spending thousands of dollars for tuition. Like, you're here to get an education. Why would you go and cheating your first year of all years too, right? It doesn't really make a lot of sense.
Honestly, the vibe I got from it is that a lot of the ones that used AI on the report that they just handed in went to high schools. We spoke about it and I didn't get the vibe that it was yours, but I would say probably high school is similar to where I went, where they probably did essays on like Lord of the Flies, stuff like that. Just like basic Ontario education. And I think they got away with using AI, and they're so reliant on it. Mm-hmm. They don't know how or want to use their brains and actually exhaust any form of muscle memory, right? Or try. So I think that's what's happened. And that's really, really bad, because now this is, it's not like I'm the first person who's seen this. Like, they got in a habit of that in grade 12. And it's really difficult if you've discredited all the skills you were supposed to learn then to, you know, start learning my skills, because you cheated back then too. And it's just a spiral. I was talking to my colleagues about how dangerous that is in terms of employability.
Yeah.
And I think I'm going to tell my students that, like, you're completely making yourself unemployable.
Yeah, it's tough. You know, AI is even pretty big at our school right now. Like, literally, I will walk by students' laptops and they have like ChatGPT, like literally open. Like, they're not even like hiding it, right? They don't use it for my class because thankfully I teach accounting, and it's actually, I'm not even worried about AI, because there's no way they can actually even use it in my class, to be honest with you.
Which is what you said. Yeah.
Yeah. There's no, they write one report, but it's a very personal report. There's all these different contexts that AI wouldn't be able to generate a sufficient report for them anyways, but everything else is either presentations or written on tests and paper and pen. So I'm not too worried about AI personally. My course is AI proof, but there are other classes at my school, your traditional English class, history classes, your essay written classes, that it's a thing. And students, they won't out each other, but I've had kids come up to me and say, "Hey, Mr. Hay, like, I don't know what to do. I'm kind of stuck in this position where I don't want to snitch on these people because I don't want to be that person," but AI is definitely being abused right now. And we have it in our code of conduct, and I know there's people that have been caught and they don't pay me enough to have to deal with that stuff. That kind of gets filtered to the upper levels and they deal with it. So I don't know what actually happens to those kids, but Yeah, it's happening at the ground level. So I'm not surprised that the ones that maybe don't get caught continued using AI at the university level, right?
Yeah, and then it's just crazy to risk that at the university level. I just would never do that, like risk being like possibly caught for plagiarism. It's very serious.
Yeah, no, it is really, really serious. Switching gears for a moment, though, outside of AI, another big part of being a high school teacher is the prep for each lessons. What does your preparation look like for a university class?
Yeah, so what's really cool about our department is we actually, as a department, all the lecturers that teach the same course meet every single Tuesday, and whoever is in charge of that unit, so for example, I was in charge of finance and I'm also in charge of organizational behavior. You are the person who runs that weekly meeting, and you basically walk everyone else through the way that we should uniformly teach the concepts that we teach that week. And then we just keep repeating that every single week. And then of course I'm responsible on my end. There are decks and that everyone uses as a base deck, but we're allowed to edit it. I like to add my own stuff. So yeah, it's very cool because we're very uniform, but there's a lot of room to do your own thing if you wanted to. And that's what I've really been loving about my second year is I've finally found the confidence to do that by myself. Whereas I feel like in first year, you know, you're almost like, I have to do it by the book. I'm too scared. So I've been really loving finding, you know, how does Emma want to teach, right? How does Emma want to teach these concepts? Because that's different than how Ron would teach these. And that's okay. And that's exciting.
Yeah. What was it like in your first year? I know you're still a fairly new teacher. And I know being a first year teacher, whether it's high school or university or elementary, it's always challenging. How was that transition from being in school to now running your own classroom for you?
Yeah. So I would say it's crazy to think about because it was the best thing that's ever happened to me, but also simultaneously the scariest thing that's ever happened to me. I can remember teaching specifically in summer school when I was training, and I just literally the whole time was soaked in sweat. Like I just never calmed down. And I'm a very extroverted person. I love public speaking, but for some reason, the pressure of teaching people who are educated enough to know what you're talking about, know what's going on and want to be there and want to learn was just so horrifying for me. So I would say for a lot of my first year, one of the biggest things I struggled with was confidence. Like for example, if a student would push back on me, I'd be horrified to actually go with my gut and stick with what I knew was right.
Yeah.
I don't know why they're 18 years old. I don't know what I thought that was, but it was just all in my head. So what's really beautiful about my second year is I'm just so much more confident. And I think that the key to being a good teacher is confidence. And I've really seen that in my growth from first to second year.
And you know what? I'm not surprised about that comment. I think that's very common. In fact, I've heard that from elementary school teachers, right? Like they'll be teaching curriculum and, a kid will ask a question or push back and they'll be like, oh, wait a second. Are they right? Like, wait a second. They're 5 years old. wait a second.
What's 5 times 6?
Yeah. They're like, wait a second. I don't know. But no, I think that's every grade. I don't think that's a university thing. I think that is a similarity between, our different worlds is, yeah, it takes a little bit of time to build that confidence. You're in front of a room trying to educate people and you want to make sure that you give the right information and you feel the responsibility of giving accurate information and instruction because that's what you're being paid to do. So yeah, I don't blame you at all.
Absolutely. Yeah. It's almost like if I do mess up, like what you just said, like their education's literally in my hands and it felt like the end of the world. But now I know like if I misspeak or I mess up, like I can, there's always tomorrow. Yeah. I can always tell them tomorrow.
Yeah.
It is not that big of a deal. So I guess it was just tough building that confidence. And I just feel like I wasn't as lenient on myself as I should have been. Like you just said, like I was 22 years old teaching 80 students at a time curriculum that I just learned 4 years ago. Like it's pretty new.
Yeah,
so,
100%.
I think if I were to give advice to anybody else, it would just be kinder to yourself in the beginning and like trust the process of it. If you feel good doing it, but you also feel nervous. Eventually the nervous goes away and just the good takes over. And I think that's
Yeah.
beautiful.
I think the advice I give to my students that someone gave to me when I first started out is just it's okay to tell your students that you don't know. And I think a lot of times that we expect ourselves to know everything for every single question that gets thrown at us. And you get nervous. You're like, oh my God, how did I not know this? But you could just say, listen, I don't know. That's a great question, Johnny. Let me get back to you. Right?
Absolutely.
All right.
Another really great tool is throwing it back at the class and being like, yeah, that's a good question. Who knows the answer to this? And pretending like you do know. And
yeah.
it's like, actually,
that's a classic. That's a veteran move.
That's my favorite. That's smart thinking.
So I'm looking at the time right now. I think we got to wrap this up, Emma. Maybe we could wrap this up by what has been the most memorable part of your job right now, whether it's a student interaction or just something that happened, and what's been the most challenging part of your job in the last 2 years?
Yeah, so I will start with the most challenging and then end with the most memorable, because I think the memorable is very beautiful and I think it's a really good story and I'm just really excited to tell it.
Yeah.
And then I'll start with the challenging
Sure, please.
first. So I would say the most challenging thing for me, like I said, was one, finding that confidence. And I just feel like I was so nervous and so hard on myself for no reason. And I didn't trust my intelligence as much as I should have. And I think that also comes from graduating from a business school where I think bro culture is unfortunately very prevalent. So I don't think I even had confidence as a student. So I think what's really beautiful though is like this job has helped me find that. So that's one of the most challenging things. And then the second most challenging thing is definitely dealing with students when they're arguing with me about their grades. Because like I said, it's a very uncomfortable conversation to have to humble them. And you know, have to be like, here's why you got this grade and here's all the people that did better than you. It's just, I don't ever like to make someone feel that way. So that's been really challenging. But the most memorable thing that's ever happened in my career, and I'm so excited to tell the story. So thank you so much for asking.
No, go ahead.
Every single year, well, I'm only doing 2 years now, but I run a blood drive. So I challenge my students to donate blood. And the section out of my four sections that has the most donations, I throw them a pizza party, a donut party, whatever they want, I'm buying it. It's on me. And the reason for this is because when I was 16 years old, my best friend passed away after being in a car accident. So he lost a ton of blood and went through a bunch of surgeries. And the only thing that kept him going for a month before he unfortunately passed away was all the blood transfusions. And I think he had over like 200. So I'm very passionate about it. So the most memorable thing, now that you have the backstory, is on the day of his death anniversary, my students knew the day of his death anniversary because that was the day that the blood drive was ending. I got to class and every year that is just like, obviously I'm just full of grief. It's very difficult to get out of bed. And I got there and I walked in and one student handed me a bouquet of flowers and it had a card and it was from all of them.
Wow.
And I just started crying immediately. I just couldn't believe it. It was so beautiful
Wow.
that they would, you know, like just, it's crazy how special moments are like that. I'll remember that forever.
That just gave me chills listening to that. And, you know, I think that's a testament to the culture that you've built and the relationships that you've built with your students there, right? When you think, oh my God, 80 students in a class, like, you know, there's no way you'd be able to get to know all of them and build a culture with them. You just kind of just go in and teach and leave. I tell teachers that is not true whatsoever. And I think people have this perception that universities, you're just a number. But that's not necessarily true if you have a strong teacher in the classroom that cares about every single person. And I say like, no, it's your job. You're the captain of the ship and you dictate what that culture is like, whether it's with 8 kids or with 80 kids.
Yes.
And it sounded like you built this amazing, amazing culture in the classroom there. And that's, you know, all the power to you. That's a beautiful, beautiful story.
Thank you so much. I feel like exactly what you said, you only get out how much you put in. And I think it's important to put in so much for them because it's they're 18, right? It's like they only get to do this once. I think it's so important. So yeah, it's really, really beautiful when you get to see the fruits of your labor actually pay off and you can see that they appreciate you.
Yeah. I say to the caller and to really any other listeners out there, if you know, you've you're looking for a second career to transition into university lecturing. You know, it's an amazing job. It's a different world. There is a lot of similarities, as Emma pointed out. But, you know, I absolutely loved it. And I could tell from your voice that you absolutely loved it as well.
Best thing that's ever happened to me. I can't push it enough. You got to do it.
Got to do it. Well, thank you so much, Emma, for joining in on today's episode. We really appreciate it. And for those of you listeners out there, thank you guys so much again for also tuning in to today's episode of The Teacher Hotline. If you enjoyed this episode, feel free to follow me on The Teacher Hotline on Instagram and on Facebook for future episodes and more content. We'll see you guys all later. Take care. Woo!